that new mega site launched.
Yeah, and people can upload their stuff again.
Yeah. So we talked, like a year ago, we talked in podcast number 23 and 24 about the shutdown of Mega Upload. And now the people behind it, Kim.com and others, despite still being under indictment, I think, in the U.S. and stuff like that, and having been raided a year ago, they have a new site up, mega.co.nz. And, it's basically like a storage locker site. So I guess it basically competes with, I would say most closely with something like Google Drive. Now, Google Drive and Dropbox, say another competitor, also offer folder syncing in on your desktop, like on your Mac or your Windows, right? So that is a little bit different, but overall, like, yeah, it gives people, I don't know, like a certain amount, something like 50 gigs of free storage space, and then a limited amount of bandwidth, and it basically just works off the web, you know, uploading and downloading files. And I guess you can share links to files, and that's how people would share files. And the system is designed to be encrypted. There's been some criticisms of its security, but the idea is that it's supposed to be encrypted in the browser, and there's I guess the encryption is bound up with the password. So I heard you really can't lose your password, but because, you know, like the encryption is, you know, linked in with that and everything. But the system is designed so that they don't see what the file is on their servers when they're hosting it at Mega. You know, just the customer sees it, and then when they give their password and it encrypts in the browser, you know, it's not really supposed to be visible to the people on the server.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what people really want. You know, they just want a private place to store stuff on the web.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, like, I wasn't a Mega Upload user. I'm not really sure, you know, about, you know, like, of course, like, look what happened to Mega Upload. They shut it down. And I think it was a excessive kind of raid. I think it's questionable, very questionable, whether they really should have shut it down at all. And, you know, I think you have all these sites where, you know, you have to be concerned where the site might go offline and you could lose your data. But in terms of having one place where you store your data, you know, I guess some people, you know, might try it. I have it open on the computer here, and I uploaded, a few of the songs that we've recorded with our band Niner, and, like a couple of the books I've written and that I have on my website. Well, you know, here now I have them stored on Mega. I don't know, you know, so I guess it can, you know, it works for storing basic files, but in terms of what people are really going to use it for, I'm not sure. But like you said, you know, the privacy, that is actually what they're selling. They're selling the idea of privacy, right? You know, and because it really is legitimate, and whether these guys are going to be the ones to provide that service, I think the idea of a service that provides cloud storage but still offers privacy is a great idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, they're down in New Zealand there. Yeah, so, you know, it's like, you know, it's not clear whether they're actually going to extradite Kim.com to, the main guy behind it to, like, go, you know, to trial, you know, in the U.S. for Mega Upload. You know, it's like such a trumped up case, you know, and they tried to make it something more than a copyright issue. And, you know, like all those sites have stuff that gets uploaded to them, right? They have to deal with. There's a lot of sharing of sites. Now, this is an example of a centralized site. This is a site where they had, you know, they have a server that you upload to. And of course, if the government, you know, seizes the site, then the site can basically be shut down. At least the access to that URL can be shut down, because the government will interfere with the DNS system. They've shown they're willing to do that, right, with sites they don't like. You can see how, like, WikiLeaks moved, you know, to WikiLeaks.ch because, you know, they're trying to, they went to the Swiss domain register because I guess they trusted that more. I don't know. all the reasons for that. But, you know, so people have to be very careful because the idea, you know, that your domain is your property as long as you renew it, well, you know, the government seems intent on interfering that, you know, and it's a great violation of the free speech, right? They're not even just taking away, like, what you've written. They're taking away your platform to write or express what you want.
Yeah. And we have to keep it free, you know. That's what it's all about. That's what we have as people, you know, is our freedom.
Yeah, and when you see, you know, sites that where people store their data, whether you're looking at a Dropbox or a Mega or something, typically people are storing mostly just their own personal files and, you know, using that, using those services for that. Where people get files where if they want to download something from popular media and stuff is often from peer-to-peer systems like BitTorrent, stuff like that, right? So, I mean, that's a whole different category of stuff. And actually, there's a whole other level of peer-to-peer. Of course, you know, you can talk about protocols on the internet and, you know, the way you can use different, you know, different connections to maybe kind of blur the lines between traditional client and server roles. But how about the world of, I guess, what some people call the peer-to-peer sharing economy. There's this article in this blog, Rough Type, by Nick Carr. It's called The Intricate Rented World.
Interesting.
And he's talking about stuff like, well, peer-to-peer sharing. He's talking about an article in Forbes, which, I mean, you know, of course, you know, Forbes is pretty stupid. So, mm-hmm. You know, he's talking about, you know, companies like Airbnb, and he mentions Lyft with a Y, and dog vacay. I don't know, you know, like, but there's Airbnb. That's the, it's a company where I feel like what I've heard mostly is people complaining that their apartment got trashed because they did some apartment exchange and they went somewhere, but then someone came to their town.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so it just sounds sleazy, you know, like, and basically not to, you know, speak for this article. You read it yourself. Just find the link at the show notes, djmcloud.com, and look for podcast number 70. But basically, you know, he's talking about how things like zoning laws and regulations, you know what I mean, the roles of home and hotel and stuff like that are kind of there for a reason. And this is like a kind of ridiculous, over-the-top kind of like capitalism run amok story, not like a great sharing peer-to-peer economy new, you know, system, kind of like you know, hopeful story. It's actually like a sign like, well, some people actually, you know, basically really only have the place they live in their car, so they, you know, work doing taxi work and renting their house out and living in one room and showering at the gym, because that's, they're making use of their assets. But, you know, he kind of points out there's the downside to this. The economy's bad and people are in these situations, you know, like, it's like, you know what I mean? I do think it's pretty farcical. So it's a good article to kind of bring out that kind of, some of that, there's a lot of nonsense in the current startup scene. And there's some of those startups that are in that area, like the Airbnb type thing, I've always thought seem kind of shady.
Well, it sounds like a great article. And where can we get it?
Well, yeah, if you want to actually go get that article, it's at roughtype.com. So okay. You can go right there and look for it or follow the link in the show notes. After that, like, you know, I wanted to bring up CNET. It's been a while since you worked there.
Yeah.
Well, and we're not actually going to talk about the division of it that you worked in. I'm talking about the tech review side, and I'm talking about right now. So that Greg Sandoval guy quit because, you know, it becomes such a farce. There's this Dish Network or Dish TV, I don't know, product. I think it's called The Hopper or something, which, yeah. I mean, it sounds like a terrible name, and I don't really know. I think it's in that DVR space, but I don't know. We seem to, you know, so there's this product, and I guess it was getting good reviews, and I think it was their best in show for something, or their best in class in a review.
Best
something.
In show. So, and they liked the ability that you could push save things to your iPad.
Okay.
And yeah, so they really liked it.
So then what happened?
It was the best of CES.
Yeah.
Their parent company, CBS, is in litigation with Dish Network, so
okay.
They can't recommend any products with any companies that they're in litigation with. So they had to retract their award. And I don't know if they actually announced it, but I think they did announce it, and then they had to retract it.
Yeah, so
it got out.
Yeah, so it was this real like farce, and so I mean, it really seems like you know, CNET looks kind of ridiculous. It seems like CNET right now, you know, their editorial policy seems to be just in favor of whatever their parent company CBS tells them to say. I mean, that's I've always thought there was a line. I always thought Microsoft seems to have paid in big with CNET advertising wise or something, because they always, I thought, overcovered about Microsoft. Even Microsoft was really down there in like the zeros, you know, and stuff, and not doing anything, still just Windows XP, and yet they seem to be more positive than reasonable with their coverage. But I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm not a big Microsoft fan, but anyway, I think like now it's become an open joke. Like, I'm saying they maybe were a lot more credible than a piece of trash like Wired, but they weren't always, do you know what I mean? They were always like amenable to Google and Microsoft threatening advertising to them. I mean, I think Google openly did that one time when they wrote an article about Eric Schmidt like years ago. Like, I mean, they are not that big, and they would get pushed around by advertisers, but now that they're part of CBS, they are big, at least part of a big company, and yet they're getting pushed around by the parent company. So I don't know what's better, right? I mean, but it's turned into an open farce. You don't have to hear things or read carefully to think that it's maybe a little slanted. It's just an open joke now.
Yeah, and it just shows that there's no editorial, like, chutzpah over there. Like, who's their editorial director that didn't just stand up and fight for this and just say, you know...
That's the problem.
Or who didn't know the policy then well enough to bring this up before it got to this level and say, hey guys, we can't pick Dish because according to our policy, we're in litigation with them. So, you know, that person wasn't informed, or if they were and they wanted to fight it, they didn't do a good job of it, they didn't stand up, and they lost a lot of staff, and you know, I mean, that staff's been there for a long time.
It really shows a lot, a lack of savvy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That it even got that far, especially. I mean, that's a good point.
Well, it just shows that, you know, like, you know, CBS Interactive is really run by the corporate, but in New York, and they're in San Francisco, so...
Wait, CNET is in San Francisco.
CNET's in San Francisco, yeah, so there's a lot of trans communication, and I could see how that could happen, you know, but it's important when you do acquisitions to keep everybody informed of things.
Well, yeah, and that acquisition happened a while ago now, but
oh yeah,
there's just not, I mean, I guess I was a little surprised that the CNET brand is still around. Like I would kind of thought that site would redirect to like cbstech.com or something by now, which I don't even know if it's a site, but whatever, you know.
I think they felt they had more equity in the brand of CNET, but maybe now is a good time to break and relaunch with CES.
Yeah, because even before I moved out to San Francisco in 2002 and met you, even before then, I was a reader of CNET, like when I was in college, like in the 90s. That was like a good way to keep, you know, take a peek at the tech news. Just see some of the stuff happening, and they had a, you know, sort of a Silicon Valley, San Francisco kind of vibe, and then, you know, yeah, I mean, they have their headquarters there in San Francisco, and they were like a internet media company, and they actually kind of, you know, they had their own stock, right? And they had like a big run where in 2000 they were sort of a hot property. Whereas I think Wired had long been acquired by 2000, say, by, I'm guessing, by Condé Nast, but I don't know. You know, and other properties that were maybe a similar size at one point. I mean, this CNET rode up and then rode down. And then their stock kind of moved sideways and maybe up slightly, you know, in the zeros. But it wasn't a huge ride, right? It was pretty, I mean, maybe by, you know, after a while. But you know, it you know, I should just check their stock. Like, do they think they still have historic information about the stock, like in a financial site?
Maybe.
So what do you think? Like, of do you think that thing to do would have been stay independent? What happened? Did they have their hand forced with the acquisition? I know their CEO got forced out a few years before they got acquired.
Yeah, I don't know. It happened pretty quick, I remember. I think that's why they sold off Webshots, and I don't know what else they were trying to clean house on. Maybe just Webshots. But they wanted to lighten the load, because then after that they got acquired by CBS.
Yeah. I mean, somebody like, I mean, so somebody was probably going to buy them, I guess.
Yeah, they were setting themselves up, I guess, to be sold, basically.
So they were kind of an internet-only media play, right?
Yeah.
What happened to those kinds of companies? Like, I guess there was another wave of like blogs, like TechCrunch and Read Write Web and Ars Technica, and so I guess Ars Technica had been around a while, but there was this kind of group of like blogs that were kind of became Mashable, that became like the tech industry sort of the fashionable you know, news outlets of the tech industry, right? And CNET had that space where it was online, but it was very 90s, like maybe even now it's look, it's tech coverage, its culture is very 90s. It has like a like, in a way, it's a pure internet company, at least historically, right? It was, you know, what, even unlike, say, Wired, which was really a magazine that became, like, a website and stuff. Like, you know, fitting more into the traditional publishing model. It was more, CNET was, like, just, you know, an online website, but before there was really a blog. Like, it wasn't a blog that got really big and expanded and started having a bunch of side blogs and then got a little too big and cut back. It was always a publication, like a, you know what I mean?
Right. Like, we're here to review things. We're going to have, you know, some, like, a journalistic ethics and standards, so to speak. You know, we're not going to get paid. But, I mean, I definitely heard, you know, let's be nice, Microsoft's a big advertiser. Let's give it 3.5 stars, you know. Like, there was definitely some of that. And that's the part about working in journalism that disgusted me, was advertising. Couldn't stand it. Totally compromised everything I had studied and wanted to work for. So I just, I like advertising free media, you know, supported by the people.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that the problem that CNET faced is that they kind of, they didn't really, they would always, they would try to have it both ways. Like, you're right, they would do, like, reviews kind of more modeled on Consumer Reports than anything online, right? And then they would do a gadget blog. But then they'd, like, complain that all the other gadget blogs would get scoops, and they would hide behind the newsroom kind of thing, like, because again, they're like a transitional company, they had that kind of stodgy newsroom kind of like vibe, so it'd be like, well, we don't get the early scoops. Well, I don't think they got the early scoops, you know, like, they claimed they had journalistic standards and they had to check things, but really it depends on, you know, like, well, the blogs with the high traffic and the cool name are going to get the stuff leaked to, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, well, if you're going to deal with CNET, wouldn't you deal with the review people first, not the Crave people? Or I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seemed like so bolted on, you know, like, this is, you know, like, oh, we're realizing that other people are starting gadget vlogs, that there's like Engadgets and stuff like that out there now. So we have to respond to that.
Yeah. I mean, when I was there, I could see the potential of them becoming a really big, you know, online media company, and you know, they had some really high-end advertising and were trying to do a lot of different things. But sometimes it was a case of, you know, leadership gone wrong, lots of different changes and acquisitions in a short period of time. The scandal with Shelby through the time I was there. Shelby, I think, was I don't know if he was there when I was there, or he was just kicked out, or he didn't kick out, but, you know, he left. Then we had this weird guy when I was there, and then the acquisition. So it's just, it's been kind of a rocky road with leadership, and they didn't really get like a good focus and a good synergy between all the properties.
Shelby Bonney.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was forced out, or it appeared that he may have been forced out. He left.
Right. There was some scandal related to the financials, I'm going to leave.
It was one of those stock option scandals, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something in that, general field.
Yeah, I got stock options, but I didn't work there long enough to get them fully vested.
Yeah, I think that's probably kind of good, though, that you only worked there for a few years. I mean, it was an interesting experience visiting you there and checking it out. But, they were in a transitional period there. Like, they were basically, like, still a 90s company. They had the whole newsroom and stuff, but they didn't have the print distribution system where, you know, like, they didn't have, right? They were online and they were trying different things, and, you know, yeah, where was their big profit driver? It was just advertising, and then online advertising, I mean, that just goes in really harsh cycles, and it's just doesn't really go up that high at the top of the cycle these days, does it?
It sure doesn't.
Yeah, what do people do if they want to advertise online? Like, is Google AdWords still the thing that, I mean, I guess if you're doing something like if you're one of those bankruptcy attorneys, but what do people do for advertising online? It's, Twitter?
Yeah, it's content sponsorships. So it's, you know, it's bringing something that your audience wants to see that's related to your product. So, you know, for some, it's easier than others, but what can you provide? Is it a webinar? Is it a an event? Is it some type of content that people can have that has your brand on it that relates to what you do? You know, is it recipes? Is it 10 tips for writing a blog post? Whatever it is that you can give and share, what's that value point that's really going to hook people in?
Do you think it's a good, like, all right, my view is that podcast advertising is still very ghettoized. Like, I don't like advertising, I don't want advertising, but, like, you know, isn't podcast advertising still kind of like, isn't it marginalized because, like, the audience isn't as big as people that listen to podcasts think it is?
Yes, but I think depending on the podcast, you know, it could be almost like an endorsement. Like, the person will be like, look, I'm not going to talk to you guys about any product on here unless I really believe in it. And then, sure, why not get some money to help promote something?
If you have a weekly podcast, awesome. Sorry.
I don't know.
So you have to, but no, that's a good formula. If you can find people that,
there's a couple people that do that, you know, and, you know, so as consumers, you feel like you can trust them because they're not going to show you stuff that they themselves don't like. And even stuff that they like, if stuff's not so good, like if there's something that's not great, they'll let you know that too.
Yeah.
They'll be like, warning, don't get this, or cool, watch out for this, or this isn't so great, or whatever.
You know, because, like, people, when they advertise on podcasts, it's, like, stuck in there. Like, there's no good technology for ripping the ads out. They're just stuck in the archives. So it's, like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like it really, it's a lot worse than people think. Like, it really lowers the value of your podcast when you have stupid ads in there. Now, I have, like, podcatchers where I can skip ads. Don't worry, I'm not listening to ads. No way. I'm not going to be bothered. Sometimes when I'm doing something, I'm like, you know, I don't know, let's say, you know, putting, carrying stuff in the cold between the car and the house, and I have, like, stuff in my hands, and then an ad comes on. I mean, I'll usually just reach for the button to hit pause or whatever. But I'll just not listen to anything then, instead of listening to the stupid ad. If I can reach it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Nobody likes to have ads interrupt their...
But, I mean, it's like, it's one of the...
listening experience.
Yeah, it's one of the most embedded in their things. And there's no, like, I guess the closest thing to a DVR technology is, like, a podcatcher. Like, I think there are different patterns, you know, noise patterns. Like, wouldn't that be a cool podcatcher app feature to, like, skip over commercials by recognizing the patterns of the commercials?
Yeah, for sure.
There's gotta be, like, different sonic signatures. The drop in the voice in terms of enthusiasm. The, you know, the contempt for the people giving them money.
The volume.
Yeah, and then the ass-kissing of other guests. That's the worst, when other guests start ass-kissing the product. It's just like, see, people are just ass-kissers, like a lot of people. So, like, don't give them ad copy to read. God help you.
Okay.
I'm gonna code it. I'm gonna produce it that way. I'm the producer. I love that. How do you know?
Well, you said that there's nothing on there.
Yeah, no, there isn't actually. It's just, I'm just saying I'll fill it in with the musical interlude. I'm just looking for a closeout cut. You got anything?
I could tell a story about the birds and their water dish.
What happened with the birds and their water dish?
Well, I got fresh water for the birds, and I put it in their cage, and I thought they were going to go down and drink it, because they usually do. But this time, they were like dunking their head in and getting really crazy, and they were almost like doing a diving contest, as you said when you tweeted out my video that I shot of it. So we'll include that maybe in the show notes, and you can get a link to the video. But you can see them like diving in, putting almost half their whole body in underneath all the water, especially Sparta and Dodger. Belle did a little bit and then went up and groomed, and the two of them just went back and forth, and it is quite hilarious.
That's a really good video you took, for sure. Yeah, I did tweet that. So definitely check the show notes, and there's a link to that video. So yeah, the show notes are at djmcloud.com, and look for podcast number 70, and you can send us feedback. Just send it to podcast@djmcloud.com. pacificpelican.us. Check out Jessica's website, jessica.sf3am.com. And you can subscribe to the podcast and find a link to the blog at danieljmckeown.com. And thanks for listening to the episode number 70 with me, Dan McKeown, and with Jessica.
Thanks, everybody.
Cool, and this has been recorded on January 27th, 2013. Novel, Crossing the Continental Divide. If you want to download the book and read it first, just go over to djmcloud.com/novel, and there's a link to free EPUB, PDF, and iBooks versions.
Down into the ocean.